So this morning we're continuing our study in the book of Job. We are very close to the end. We'll be looking in chapter 40 and probably 41 today. I don't think we'll probably finish everything in chapter 41, but I think we're going to get into some of that. Today we're going to be looking at primarily a couple of these animals that God talks about, the behemoth and leviathan, which are very interesting. Just to recap from last week, we were looking in chapter 39. We pointed out how the focus of chapter 39, when God's talking about all these animals in chapter 39, is really on how they behave. Excuse me. And not all that behavior that was discussed seems to be presented in a way that makes the animals look very majestic. In fact, you know, some of it seems counterintuitive. Like, why would God specifically say he made the ostrich forget wisdom and leave her eggs and abandon her young? So these things these animals are doing in some cases seem to be counterintuitive. And we talked about how I'm proposing that chapter 39 is God's way of challenging Job and really any man. Who would find fault with how and what he created by saying, here's some examples if you want to take some. Take a look at these animals and explain to me, based on your wisdom and how you can interpret things, why they do the things that they do. And, you know, the answer for us is it really doesn't make sense why these animals behave that way. And I think the point is that God is saying he's not going to defend himself to man for the stuff that doesn't seem to make sense to us. And of course, that would tie in very well to some of the overall lessons we take from Job. God is, in fact, saying some things will happen. You won't understand why those things are happening, and I owe you no explanation. At the end of the day, as the Creator, he doesn't have to explain himself to us. But of course, there's a lot else going on here as well. It's not just God shutting down Job and saying, deal with it. Right, there's more going on here, and I think that we're going to see some of that too as we get into chapters 40 and 41. And really, I think that it's good to set that foundation, and I think that's what the book of Job's intending to do. That let's just take into account what our reality is. This is our reality. We didn't create ourselves. We don't get to choose what type of existence we were born into. We are born into God's creation. We are his creation, and it's his world created for his purpose. And there are some things that might happen that don't make sense, but we have to operate within that reality because we can't just choose a different one, right? We can't say, this one doesn't really work for me, so I'm going to choose something else. That's not really an option that we have. So we have to work within the reality that is ours. And I think that part of that reality, like we said, is God's going to do some things that don't make sense to us, and we may not get a good explanation, or at least a satisfactory explanation for us. So the question or challenge to us then is, what do we do with that? That's our reality. What are we going to do with that? How are we going to respond to it? And we talked about how, as God created us, he understands and anticipates that we will have an emotional reaction to that reality. We're not going to say, okay, and not worry about it anymore, right? I mean, there's some major implications of those things that pertain to our own sense of security, just in how things work. So what is our reaction going to be? And we talked about some of the different reactions when we confront that that's our reality. We could hate God. We could decide, I don't want to serve a God who's going to do things that don't make sense to me, and he doesn't have to explain himself. That doesn't work for me. And you could take it to the extreme of even hating him or deciding that because there are some unsavory things about him in your estimation that you're not even going to believe in him anymore. Or you could put your confidence in him and you could put your trust in him and say, he did say there's things that will happen that I may not understand, but he also said that he's got this. He's going to take care of it and he intends to work it out for our good. Long term, eventually, it'll work out. And, you know, part of the evidence for wanting to go that direction, again, just speaking very foundational stuff here. We're not getting into the whole gospel yet or anything like that. But very foundational stuff is if we think that it's not necessarily going to be a good thing for us to live in an existence where a God might do things that don't benefit us and doesn't make sense to us. How much worse would it be if there is no ultimate justice? There is no ultimate judgment. And the only good that we have are the things that we have to amass for ourselves, because that's all we get to offset all the evil that's coming our way. So I think it's really that's where I think God is trying to reset Job's mind in all of this. It's like, look, live in reality. Okay, this is your reality. So what's your response going to be? So this week we're going to cover chapter 40 and 41. And again, there's a whole lot more to talk about there. And if we didn't cover something in class adequately, if you have a question for me, you know, let me know. I love talking about this stuff. This is really interesting stuff to me. And I can't go as broadly as I want to and without losing control of the class. So you know, let me know if you want to talk about any of that offline. But let's get into chapter 40 now. And we looked at the first couple of verses last week, but we'll go ahead and reread those. So verses 1 through 5 of Job chapter 40. And the Lord said to Job, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it." So again, this is God kind of, I think, summarizing his points in chapter 39. And now it's Job's turn to talk. In verse 3, "Then Job answered the Lord and said, 'Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further.'" So there's a little bit of variance here in what could be meant depending on the translation. The Septuagint, which if you'll remember is the Greek version of the scriptures, that the oldest copies of the Greek version that we have are actually older than the Hebrew copies that we have. From which most of our English versions were translated, which is the Masoretic texts. The Septuagint is a little bit clearer here, and I'm actually going to go to the Septuagint a little bit because I think it really helps us understand some things here. It gives us a little bit different perspective to understand what's being talked about. But in the Septuagint, Job is basically saying, "I've spoken once and I'm not going to speak again." That's kind of what he says in the Septuagint. It doesn't get into the twice thing like that. So I don't read too much into the "I've spoken once, I've spoken twice." I don't try to break that down in too much detail because I think the point is Job saying, "I don't want to say anything." That's the point, right? Job is it's gotten real for him. This isn't going the way that he envisioned. Remember back when he was kind of fantasizing about this encounter he would have with God, how he would be able to come to God and present his case, and God wouldn't be able to answer him, and now he's the one who can't answer. And he's at least wise enough to realize, I don't want to speak right now. I don't want to say anything. So, verses 6 through 14. "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? Have you an arm like God, and can you thunder with a voice like his? Adorn yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on everyone who is proud and abase him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below. Then I will acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you." So again, there's another small variation here between the Septuagint and the Masoretic texts that to me helps inform our understanding of this in a way that isn't obvious just reading the way we've read it. So in the Septuagint, verse 8, which I just read as, "Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right?" Is different in the Septuagint. It reads, "Do not set aside my judgment. Do you think that I have dealt with you in any other way than that you might appear to be righteous?" Which is a different idea than what we're reading here, because in verse 8 here, it seems like God is really calling Job to task. Like he's really taking him to task. But in the Septuagint, the idea is, do you think that I'm doing this for some other reason than to justify you? Because that's ultimately, I think, what the Septuagint is leading to that God wanted for Job. God wanted Job to come through this trial righteous. He didn't want to have to rebuke Job. That wasn't the point. So I think that there could be a nuance there that's kind of interesting. It's not just a contest of wills that's going on here, but God was looking to prove Job's righteousness to this Satan who challenged him, right? That's what God wanted. He wanted Job to come through this. So it's not like God was hoping Job would fail so that he could rebuke him. And I think that we can take that conclusion, even whether we go with the Septuagint or not. Let's keep that in mind. It's not like God wanted Job to fail. It's not like he wanted to give him. He was just waiting for an excuse to give him a rebuke, right? And I think there's just more going on here than God simply calling out Job's weakness in a contest of wills. So some of the common threads between the two texts, if you look at the Septuagint versus the Masoretic here in chapter 40, is there's a lot of emphasis on who justifies whom. God can justify and save Job. Job cannot do that on his own. You know, as we read, God says, if you can do all these things, I will acknowledge that your own right hand can save you. Of course, Job can't do those things. So yes, it's a rebuke, right? But it's also this promise of deliverance. It's hinting towards Job's redemption, right? God is going to deliver Job. And God wants Job to recognize, Job, that's not something that you did. That's something I'm doing for you. I will pull you out of this. So Job's vindication is coming. And I don't think it's a coincidence, too, that as you read through this and we talk about God executing judgment in verses 10 through 14, he's talking about pouring out the overflowings of his anger, looking upon anyone who is proud and abasing him, on everyone who is proud, bring him low and tread down the wicked where they stand, hide them all in the dust together and bind their faces in the world below. Very much judgment discussion there. And that's one thing that I think Job was worried about for a while, was God didn't see any difference between the righteous and the wicked. Remember, he called out that back in chapter 9. And God is reaffirming, yes, I do. I see it, and I'm doing something about it. And I don't think, like I was going to get into, I don't think it's a coincidence that when you're looking through this judgment text here in verses 10 through 13, that it's they and them. It's not you, Job, you, Job, you, Job. Right? So there's no direct condemnation of Job here. It's talking about the wicked, kind of as this group of people over here. So it's not a condemnation of Job. It's a reminder to Job that God can and will judge. He's willing to do that, and he's capable of it. So Job's vindication is coming. It's very, very close, as we're going to see it in chapter 42. All right, so let's finish this chapter, verses 15 through 24. Job chapter 40, verse 15. Behold, behemoth, which I made as I made you. He eats grass like an ox. Behold, his strength in his loins and his power in the muscles of his belly. He makes his tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of his thigh are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze, his limbs like bars of iron. He is the first of the works of God. Let him who made him bring near his sword. For the mountains yield food for him, where all the wild beasts play. Under the lotus plants he lies, in the shelter of the reeds and in the marsh. For his shade the lotus trees cover him. The willows of the brooks surround him. Behold, if the river is turbulent, he is not frightened. He is confident, though Jordan rushes against his mouth. Can one take him by his eyes or pierce his nose with a snare? So, we don't really know what Behemoth is or was. Let me just start out with that, okay? Some have proposed this is talking about a hippopotamus. And the reasons they propose that are due to the basic and obvious descriptions of it. It seems to behave like a hippopotamus would behave, right? Kind of a river-dwelling creature who can walk up into the land. It eats grass, that type of thing. Very strong and powerful. It also, the root word in Hebrew, I've read, is similar to the Egyptian word for hippopotamus. So there's that connection as well. So it could be that. That works for me. But let's be careful about binding that interpretation too tightly, because I don't know for sure what animal this is, but it sounds like a hippopotamus. Some things that are observed about Behemoth. The Behemoth seems to dwell in security. It's very powerful, right? The things that are discussed about it are how powerful it is. But it also seems like a peaceful beast. We read in here that it's not posing any threat to any other animals, right? We don't read about any of that here. And verse 19 is kind of interesting. It says, he is the first of the works of God. I don't think that that's talking about how Behemoth was the first thing that God created in chronological order. Otherwise, there'd be some obvious contradictions to work through. But first in the sense of it's exemplary of the works of God as it pertains to this conversation that's happening right now. Exemplary for the purposes of this discussion. And then again in verse 19, it says, let him who made him bring near his sword. That's very interesting too. So the Septuagint, again going back to that, renders this a little bit differently. It says, Behemoth was made to be played with by his angels, which is kind of an interesting take on this. Now, how literally, if we go with the Septuagint, how literally we're supposed to take that is definitely subject to debate. I'd read it as hyperbole. I think the point is, this is a creature you don't want to trifle with, right? This is a creature whose power is probably above yours as a man, Job. You understand that. You don't mess around with Behemoth, right? And then verse 24 is interesting too, because the ESV, there's actually a lot of variation here. The ESV presents verse 24 as a rhetorical question. It says, can one take him by the eyes or pierce his nose with a snare? And as a rhetorical question, that's no, you're not going to be able to do that, right? That's how we are to read that. Other translations of even the Masoretic text don't read that way. And it becomes apparent that the people who translated this weren't quite sure what it meant. And some of those translations don't make a lot of sense if you just read them. Because, again, we talked about this. Sometimes when there's a little bit of confusion over what an original passage meant, you'll have different approaches taken to translating that passage. Some will try to take their best shot at, with context and historical context and everything else going on, to give you the meaning of the passage as they understand it. And then others are just going to flip over the words and translate it very literally because they're not sure what it means. So you have some of that happening here. Again, I'm kind of leaning on the Septuagint a little bit this time. But the Septuagint in verse 24 is different. It says, yet one shall take him in his sight, one shall catch him with a cord and pierce his nose. And that's very deliberate in the Septuagint because it's going to set up a contrast now between Behemoth and Leviathan. It's going to say, yeah, Behemoth is really powerful, but one can catch him with a snare, but you're not going to catch Leviathan that way. Okay, so there's this contrast and this change that's happening in the Septuagint that leads to it. So the Septuagint's referring to this one who's able to subdue Behemoth. And, you know, the words that are used here, can you catch him with a cord and pierce his nose? The idea of piercing the nose is a symbol of ownership. It was something that in ancient Near East times, could actually have been practiced with humans who were taken into captivity. There are carvings and things you can see of the Assyrians. When they would take nations captive, they would put hooks in the noses of these people and run chains through the hooks and lead them by the chains. It's a very violent image and a very humbling image, one that suggests submission, complete submission and ownership, right? That this person leading this other thing around by the nose is the owner of it, right? So that's the idea here, that there is one who is able to ensnare Behemoth in this way and lead it by the nose, which is kind of interesting because we've just talked about all these strengths of Behemoth. So what is that about? So I want to offer some observations about both of these animals. We're going to talk about Leviathan here in just a minute. And I want to throw out a word of caution because what I'm about to say is independent thought. So take it with a grain of salt. Okay, this is me trying to work this out. All right. I think there's more going on here than God just saying, hey, these animals are really great. I think there's more going on here than that. I can't help but see that Behemoth is actually a really good metaphor for Job himself. And some of the evidence for that, possibly, if you back up to verse 15, where it says, "Behold, behemoth which I made as I made you. He eats grass like an ox." Of all the animals that God discusses with Job, behemoth is the only one where he says anything like this, where he kind of equates in some form or fashion this animal to Job. I don't know that he's saying they're equal, but he's saying, "I made behemoth as I made you." So just take that for what it's worth. But you can see, like, the analogy works if it's intended. Job himself, like behemoth, he was strong. He was secure. He posed no threat. Even though he was strong and secure, he posed no threat to others around him. He was a peaceful person. And he was ready when the floodwaters rose. When behemoth is talking about how the Jordan River, when it rises up to his mouth, he's still okay. Right? So when those floodwaters rise, Job was ready for that. I mean, we look at about how well he handled that initial trial. You know, he said, "The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." He was ready for this trial. But like behemoth, we find that Job was still vulnerable to one who was cunning enough to ensnare him. Because Job did get ensnared. And I believe that could be referring to the Satan, perhaps. So, as mentioned earlier, there are some contrasts now that are presented between behemoth and Leviathan, which are also interesting to me as to why they're there. So again, if you look in the Septuagint, it reads in verse 24, leading into chapter 41, it says, "Yet one shall take him, behemoth, in his sight, one shall catch him with the cord and pierce his nose. But wilt thou catch the serpent, which is Leviathan, with a hook, and put a halter about his nose? Or will you fasten a ring in his nostril and bore his lip with a clasp?" So I want to talk about, now there's going to be some contrast we can flesh out between these two creatures, behemoth and Leviathan. I think that, again, behemoth could represent Job, so hold that in mind. And I want to read chapter 41, and then let's start looking at some of the contrast that maybe we can flesh out between these two creatures, okay? So in chapter 41, we'll just read the whole chapter here. "Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many pleas to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you to take him for your servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird, or will you put him on a leash for your girls?" It's kind of funny to me. "Will traders bargain over him? Will they divide him up among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hands on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. Behold, the hope of a man is false. He is laid low even at the sight of him. No one is so fierce that he dares to stir him up. Who then is he who can stand before me? Who is first given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. I will not keep silence concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his goodly frame. Who can strip off his outer garment? Who would come near him with a bridle? Who can open the doors of his face? Around his teeth is terror. His back is made of rows and shields, shut up closely as with a seal. No one is so near to another that no air can come between them. Or one is so near to another that no air can come between them. Are they joined? They are joined one to another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. His sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the dawn. Out of his mouth go flaming torches, sparks of fire leap forth. Out of his nostrils comes forth smoke, as from a boiling pot, and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame comes forth from his mouth. In his neck abides strength, and terror dances before him. The folds of his flesh stick together, and firmly cast on him and immovable. His heart is hard as a stone, hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. At the crashing, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches him, it does not avail, nor the spear, the dart, or the javelin. He counts iron as straw, and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. For him, sling stones are turned to stubble. Clubs are counted as stubble. He laughs at the rattle of javelins. His underparts are like sharp potsherds. He spreads himself like a threshing sledge on the mire. He makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. Behind him he leaves a shining wake. One would think the deep to be white-haired. On earth there is not his like, a creature without fear. He sees everything that is high. He is king over all the sons of pride. So I do want to talk about a little bit about what is this creature. Because it kind of sounds like Godzilla. That's the image I get, right? Have you ever seen those movies when Godzilla's swimming in the ocean, how the water's breaking apart, you know, on his fins, and he's shooting fire out of his mouth and all these crazy things. So what in the world is going on here with this Leviathan creature? I do want to talk about that, but before I get into it, I want to try to keep the line of thought where we're talking about contrasting this creature with Behemoth, because I think that's what is presented to us here. There doesn't seem to be any suspension of disbelief when God's talking to Job. So Job recognizes these are two creatures. And he doesn't have to think, wait, which creature are you talking about again? So we'll get into that in a minute. But there are some contrasts set up between Behemoth and Leviathan. So like we noted, Behemoth seems to be a peaceful animal. Leviathan seems to be anything but peaceful. We're told he wages war with his mouth. And we read about how he's very aggressive and causes warriors to tremble. We see that Leviathan's home is the sea, which we've talked before. You know, anytime you kind of see this imagery, you can't help but think about chaos, right? The ocean or the seas to the ancient Near East person represented chaos. This was the stuff that God took and ordered when he created. He took that which was chaotic and formless and void. He separated and he gave order and purpose to it. So the seas to an ancient Near East mind represented chaos. So Leviathan's home is in chaos. Leviathan is a creature, a representative of chaos, if you will. We see how, like in Behemoth, like Behemoth's home is not in the sea. It's not in the chaotic sea. That's not where he's comfortable. He's steadfast on the ground. And yeah, the river can rise, and he's a river creature, but he's still grounded, right? He's not a creature of the sea, okay? So the river can rise. Behemoth remains steadfast and secure, but Leviathan is the master of the chaotic deeps. It's his home. The chaos is his home. Another contrast. So we don't go pick a fight with Behemoth, right? But at the same time, Behemoth doesn't really seem like a creature to be feared. It's something to be feared if you go try to trifle with it, but it's not aggressive. That's not the picture I get. But again, Leviathan, very much different. Interesting, too, going back to the Septuagint, where it says Behemoth is a plaything for his angels, it says that Leviathan was made for his angels to sport with, which suggests a challenge to them. So again, hyperbole as I read it, but the point being, like, as powerful as Behemoth is, Leviathan is on another level. It's on a different level here. But again, I read that as hyperbole. The word Leviathan in Hebrew describes a wreathed serpent-like creature. And then elsewhere in ancient Near East literature, which is contemporary to our Old Testament, and not just in Hebrew, not just in the Old Testament, but Leviathan commonly represented a formidable enemy and an agent of chaos. That's something that was seen in other cultures as well. If we go to Psalm 74, just to take an example from Scripture, we read about this Leviathan in verses 13 and 14. Psalm 74, verses 13 and 14, it reads, "You divided the sea by your might. You broke the heads of the sea monsters on the waters. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness." So these passages in Psalm 74 talking about this Leviathan, they are part of the psalmist praising God for his creation. And through creation, we see elements of God mastering the forces of chaos and evil. So the psalmist here is calling upon God to remember those things and to deliver them from their own enemies. That's kind of the context of Psalm 74. Remember that you created God, that you've mastered these threats. You've mastered these things. You've put things in order. So protect us from our enemies. from those evil people who are looking to ensnare us. And it's apparent that at least in this psalm, in Psalm 74, we aren't just talking about some dumb animal here. It's not just some poor dumb animal that happens to get feel the brunt of God's wrath, right? That's not the point. But obviously, this animal represents a terrible, formidable opponent and is an agent of evil. That's what it represents, okay? Kind of like the snake representing the devil in the garden. Not that the snake itself is inherently evil. We don't go around assuming every snake we see is evil, but it's what it represents. And I think you have a representation here happening as well for this creature, Leviathan. And what we read in this Psalm 74 is kind of similar to what we read in Job in its tone. This creature's ability and might and strength is talked up. But we're reminded that God is master over it. God has mastered this creature. He's created it and he's mastered it. And then, you know, another point that we have is we know that throughout the Bible, the devil himself is commonly associated with a serpent or dragon-like creature. We can go to Revelation and we can read about the representation of Satan in Revelation as this type of creature. Not even just in Revelation, but, he's very, well, even in Revelation, I think in chapter 12, he's very clearly referred to as, the ancient serpent and dragon, specifically tied to the devil. So, again, this is just me putting it all together, right? You have to take this with a grain of salt, but I do believe there's more going on in Job than just God talking about animals. But if both animals are perhaps intended to be metaphors, if Behemoth might represent Job, it seems reasonable that Leviathan might represent the Satan. That's where I'm going with this, if it isn't obvious already. That would obviously support the view that back in the first couple of chapters of Job, when this being is speaking with God about Job, that was in fact a Satan devil-like creature and not just a job description as has been proposed. That could go either way and we could retread that if we want. But this view would lean towards, no, this is actually a bad, bad dude here talking to God. So just to quickly recap some support for that, the Septuagint links Behemoth and Leviathan as part of the same argument a little more clearly than our text does, which is translated from the Hebrew Masoretic text. We find some contrasts between the two beasts that I believe are intentional and meaningful. I don't think they're just coincidence. And the metaphors match really well, and they're consistent, I think, with other metaphors we can see throughout Scripture. And finally, it would just be strange to me that these two specific animals were chosen and discussed in this manner if the metaphors were not intended. If they weren't intended, I'm not really sure why you have all this that seems to point to more going on here than just a couple of animals being discussed. So if that's what's happening here, if these animals are metaphors for Job and the Satan, then the meaning perhaps could go something like this. Job, you were strong, you dwelled in security, you were ready for when tribulation came, like when the river water rises to the mouth, but you were vulnerable to one who is cunning enough to ensnare you. And by the way, that one who ensnared you is as formidable as Leviathan. It overwhelmed you with terrors. You didn't stand a chance against this thing. It completely routed you. But you stand a chance against it with me because I master over it. I can handle this. You can't deliver yourself. I can deliver you. And I think that ties in again to the messages that God is speaking to him when he says, show me you can do all these things, Job, and I'll acknowledge that you can deliver yourself by your own right hand, that your own right hand can save you. But of course, the answer is Job can't do those things. So it's not just God putting Job in his place, although there is some of that. There is some of God wanting to reset, I think, Job's reality and make him recognize that he does need to humble himself a little bit. But there's this promise of deliverance and salvation, that his redemption is near. I mean, he's going to be vindicated very, very soon, and God's going to bring that about. So again, take all that with a huge grain of salt. That's just how it fits together for me. That's how it makes the most sense for me. So I want to try to spend a little bit of time now, and I haven't taken any comments, and I appreciate you doing that, because there's a lot to cover here if we want to try to finish in 2 weeks. But I want to hear your thoughts, maybe after class or something. Let me know if you have any. I want to talk about real quickly this Leviathan and what is it? Is this a real creature or not? Should we believe in it or not? It seems to me that the way it's presented in the text, it's intended to be presented as a real creature. It's not just a metaphor. It wouldn't make sense for anyone to make a metaphor out of two things that aren't real. Right? So what God is doing is he's taking something that's real and he's using it to teach Job something that he wants Job to understand. If that first thing isn't real, or if he has to first convince Job this first thing exists, then the metaphor falls apart. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't work that way. So even if it's just an allegory for Satan, it doesn't work if Leviathan is not also a real biological animal. Okay? At a very basic level, again, God's using this to teach Job something that he needed to learn. Now, on one hand, we have no scientific evidence of any fire-breathing creatures. Okay, it seems very apparent to me that this is not talking about like some snake that has a fiery bite. This is a fire-breathing creature and a large one that lives in the sea. I mean, an honest reading of Job is going to have to accept that. That's what this is talking about here. We don't have any scientific evidence of fire-breathing creatures. But on the other hand, it doesn't make sense to me that this book, which was obviously crafted with a lot of wisdom, and nobody really debates that either. Like, people who've really studied Job, they don't see this as a work of foolishness. This is considered a masterpiece. Even by people who don't believe in the Bible, they're like, this is a masterpiece. And it contains a lot of wisdom, and it seems unrealistic for me to believe that a book with this much wisdom would unwittingly discredit itself by forcing its hearers to believe in a creature that doesn't exist. That doesn't make sense to me. If Leviathan never existed, then I'll say the obvious, he never existed. He would not have existed at this time with them. So contemporary hearers would have had to wait, what are you talking about here? And this is further problematic because this is God talking about it, right? This is God talking about this creature. So if Leviathan never existed, it seems to me that the book of Job would have been immediately discredited by its original audience as a work of fiction and probably blasphemous at that, because now you are offering a less than flattering view of God who would go use an imaginary creature to make a point about himself and about how powerful he is and his right to rule and his ability to save. That doesn't make sense. That would be foolishness. So we have to choose one of these options, right? We either have to believe in the existence of a creature for which there is no scientific evidence, or we're going to have to reinterpret Job as some kind of parody on God, that it's actually mocking him in some way. If we don't accept that, that's where I'm at in my understanding. It doesn't make sense otherwise that God would use a non-existent creature to prove his power and right to govern this world unless it was done as a comedic device. Like, here all this wisdom has been discussed and now God shows up and he's acting like the fool. That would be what we would have to reinterpret Job in that way. And I don't think that's what the book of Job is going for at all. I mean, if I just try to separate it entirely from my own Christian beliefs, there's nobody who believes that. Nobody thinks that this is a joke. Right? Nobody thinks that it's trying to put God in this position of being laughed at. That's not the point of the book. But his answer to Job is intended to be taken seriously. So given those options, it's actually easier for me to believe in a creature for which we have no scientific evidence than it is to believe the writer of Job could have made such an obvious blunder. And yet the book would have remained as highly as regarded as scripture for thousands of years. That I can't reconcile that. Like, one thing is I lack evidence. The other side is it doesn't make sense at all. Like, it doesn't add up. So which one do you choose to grapple with? Now, beyond that, I don't know what Leviathan is. And I don't really think it's beneficial to speculate. I'll tell you that some have tried. There's many who have tried to equate it with certain dinosaurs. A lot of the young earth creationist movement see that there is a need to show that these dinosaurs were around during this time, and that's what this thing is. And then some of them must have been able to breathe fire, so they tried to show, well, is it plausible for a biological creature to breathe fire? And they'll use things like the bombardier beetle, who can spit like really hot liquid at its enemies, up to like 100 degrees C, I think I read, and burn them as an example, and electric eel as an example of creatures who can do this kind of thing as evidence of the plausibility of a creature that can breathe fire. But at the end, guys, I mean, let's call it what it is. It's speculation. We don't have any scientific evidence for this creature. Let's accept that fact. Again, let's live in our reality, right? We don't have any scientific evidence for this creature. At the end of the day, for a person who believes in God, and if you're a secular scientific mind, it's going to make you cringe. But a creature that breathes fire is no more or less probable than a creature that breathes air. Just speaking from the standpoint of, like, what are the odds that any of this could have happened in the cosmos? And as a person who believes in God, it's not a problem for me to believe that he could have created a creature like this that we either have no evidence for or doesn't exist anymore. That's just not a problem if I believe that God exists. And that is going to cause some of my scientist friends to cringe, and rightfully so from their own worldview. Because a statement like that would naturally lead into a conversation on the impasses between science and faith, and how we're thinking very differently about the world, fundamentally. I want to talk about that stuff with you guys, but I can't do it here. There's just too much to cover, but I want to get into that with anybody who's interested in that stuff, because I'm really excited about that stuff. It's really interesting because, I don't know, it's just understanding like where the foundational impasses lie is so helpful for setting expectations on how much progress can we make with people who see the world differently, and why we can't get any further than we can get, and those types of things. So let me know if you want to talk about that anymore. We almost got through it. I want to look at a few of these verses in a little more detail, because I think there's some interesting stuff in here. We'll do that next week, and then we'll plan on getting into chapter 42 next week. Thank you for letting me fill all the air in the room today. Appreciate that.